In 2009, Susanna Cahalan was 24. She was a journalist at the New York Post, in excellent health, on top of the world, really. But then something began to shift.
I couldn't concentrate on my interviews. Someone would speak, and I couldn't translate the words onto the paper. From there, I became moody, emotional. One second, I'd be laughing hysterically, happiest I've ever felt. The next second, I was crying, and I couldn't stop it, and I couldn't explain it.
That's her sharing her story at TEDx Amsterdam Women in 2013. She talked about how, over a period of weeks, she lost her mind. She began seeing things and hearing things that weren't there.
The paintings started to come alive. One of a railroad scene. And in it, a train car started to emit tufts of smoke, which came out of the frame. My dad had a bust of Abraham Lincoln, and it started to follow me with its sunken eyes.
Her left side went numb, so she went to see a neurologist who ran several tests, all inconclusive. She had two MRIs, both normal. She was dismissed as someone experiencing alcohol withdrawal or some kind of psychiatric condition. After a seizure, her parents took her to the hospital, where things only got worse.
I thought nurses were spying on me, taking notes about me. I became so certain that people were trying to persecute me, people were trying to hurt me, that I ripped an IV out of my arm and ran screaming up and down the hallways until a nurse tackled me, and I bit and punched her.
Some thought this is schizophrenia.
Schizophrenia involves two or more of the following: delusions, hallucinations, disorganized speech. At the time, I could hardly string together a sentence, a logical sentence. The onset typically occurs in late teens or early 20s, sometimes later in women. I was 24 at the time, fit the bill.
But Cahalan did not have schizophrenia.
I was the 217th person in the world to be diagnosed with a form of autoimmune encephalitis called anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis, which is a long word, very complicated word, but it's pretty easy to sum up. Basically, it's when your body's immune system begins to target and attack the NMDA receptors of the brain.
Her immune system was attacking her brain, causing inflammation. Some of you may know this story because after Cahalan recovered, she wrote a book that became a movie called Brain on Fire. I thought of Cahalan recently after I read an excellent story in The New Yorker by Rachel Aviv called Mary Had Schizophrenia, Then Suddenly She Didn't. The story was about a woman, a mother, and a medical doctor who'd lost 20 years of her life in and out of psychiatric hospitals to a treatment-resistant psychosis. She was paranoid. She had delusions. She thought people were spying on her. She thought there were cameras at her house. Then, in her 50s, she developed lymphoma, and the treatment for her cancer cured her psychosis. 20 years lost to her children, 20 years lost to her career, 20 years lost to herself. And still, no one knows for sure what caused her psychosis or why the immunotherapy for her cancer eased it. And she's not the only person who's had life-altering psychosis that was diagnosed as schizophrenia just disappear with treatment that targeted their immune system. It turns out there's a lot we don't understand about schizophrenia, what causes it, and what might treat it. How many of the 23 million people on planet Earth who are experiencing symptoms of schizophrenia are actually suffering from something else? For how many has their own immune system targeted their brain for attack? How many could be helped with some type of immunotherapy? How much psychiatry is actually immunology? A psychiatrist in Houston is among those trying to find out. from Texas Public Radio. This is Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri.
Support for TPR comes from the University of Texas at San Antonio's Brain Health Consortium, a pioneering research hub advancing neuroscience, neuroengineering, precision medicine, and more. Learn more at utsa.edu/BHC.
Now let's go to the early 90s, where a young woman named April Burrell was a college student at the University of Maryland, Eastern Shore. She had been valedictorian of her high school class and was getting all A's as an accounting major in college. Her brother told Washington Post reporter Richard Sima that April was a high achiever, and she was also friendly and outgoing. He said she just loved life. Then, suddenly, when she was 21, April developed psychosis. She began experiencing hallucinations. She couldn't communicate with people. She couldn't bathe or take care of herself. She was ultimately diagnosed with a severe form of schizophrenia, and she was institutionalized. And that was that. A vibrant young woman with her whole life in front of her was trapped in amber. And that's where she still was, in that same hospital, more than 20 years later, when Dr. Anthony Zogby encountered her. She was standing motionless by the nurse's station. Zogby learned she didn't recognize anyone, not even her family. She could not engage with anyone. She rejected touch.
You know, I first met April in early 2018, and she was really just so unbelievably ill. And I was struck by how ill she was, how young she was at the time, how confused she appeared, and it really worried me.
Now, Zogby is an assistant professor at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston in the departments of psychiatry and human molecular genetics, and the chief of neuropsychiatric genetics within those departments. But back then, he was a research fellow at a lab in Columbia University in New York. He learned that the doctors at the facility in which April had lived for decades had tried all the available treatments for schizophrenia. Antipsychotics, mood stabilizers, electroconvulsive therapy. Nothing worked.
And so I started just digging into her chart, and I found some evidence from long before that she had had some autoimmune markers that were elevated. These were things like antithyroid peroxidase autoantibodies and some anti-nuclear antibodies that are classically associated with lupus, but she didn't have any peripheral signs or symptoms of lupus. We had discussed with her family and with the treatment team at Columbia that she might benefit from a trial of steroids to see if it helps her.
So they got consent and they started treatment.
She got a dose of IV steroids, and even within a couple of days after that, she actually had already started to show evidence of responding. And this was after she had been ill for more than 2 decades, very, very severely ill and refractory to all of the typical treatments.
April had been diagnosed with treatment-resistant schizophrenia, but she was responding to this treatment, IV steroids plus a dose of immunosuppressive drug typically used in chemotherapy, and one of the lymphoma medications given to Mary, the patient I mentioned at the beginning of the show, rituximab.
She got further rounds of treatment and then ultimately was able to leave the hospital and had a pretty substantial improvement both in her cognitive symptoms, but then also in her psychosocial functioning, her ability to recognize her family, which had been gone, and many other things.
After 26 years sealed away in a sea of hallucinations and delusions, lost to her loved ones, lost to herself, April returned.
To see her get better and the hope that everyone, including her lovely family, was kind of unbelievable. You know, I cried multiple times, especially when I first saw her clock, which is a test that we use to document cognitive function. When I saw her clock improve so dramatically, I just couldn't believe it.
The clock. If you've heard of the clock test, it may be in relation to the president who has talked about taking and acing the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. The clock test is part of that screening tool designed to detect cognitive impairment or dementia. It was also a turning point for Susanna Cahalan.
Now, the clock test is typically given to stroke and Alzheimer's patients. It's not given to 24-year-old girls. But he did it anyway. He gave me a piece of paper and asked me to draw a clock.
She did her best.
I had squished, as you can see, all the numbers on the right-hand side of the clock.
This was the result her doctor had been hoping for.
No one with a psychiatric condition would draw a clock like that. This was his proof. He actually pulled my parents aside, took them outside my room, and said, "Her brain is on fire."
Cahalan's immune system was attacking her brain, and that was something he could treat. Before April Burrell's treatment, her clock test did not resemble a clock in any meaningful way. But as Zogby noted, after she started treatment, she drew a circle and crowded her numbers all on one side like Cahalan did when her brain was on fire. That was an improvement. After three cycles of treatment, April's clock looked like a clock.
It was just a very emotional experience. And although we were happy to see that she was getting better, there's a sadness that's mixed in right there, knowing that a person's life for 20 plus years, she was in some ways trapped in this state.
This experience altered the course of Zogby's career.
I know it was a single case, but it was so extreme in so many ways that it really opened up in my mind just the possibility that there may be other cases out there like this, which is what motivates a lot of my research today, is trying to make sure that we identify any other cases that are like this.
It's kind of a mission because even cases like Susanna Cahalan's, which can be diagnosed with a test of the cerebrospinal fluid, get missed. And there's no way to know how often. April Burrell's diagnosis was just a guess, and doctors still don't know what was going on with Mary from the New Yorker article and why she responded to immunotherapy. Zogby is convinced there is an untold number of others losing years or perhaps even their lives to autoimmune encephalitis diagnosed as schizophrenia, and there's no way to test them for it.
When we talk about things like autoimmune encephalitis, it's really important to think about the semantics of what that means. Autoimmune, of course, meaning attack on the self by the immune system, and encephalitis meaning inflammation of the brain. And there are kind of classical forms of autoimmune encephalitis, like NMDA receptor encephalitis, like brain on fire. But we think, and this is still actively debated in the academic and clinical literatures, that there likely is a subset of patients who have what we would call an autoimmune psychosis, where they may not have MRI or cerebrospinal fluid evidence of clear inflammation. They don't turn up positive for any of those tests, yet they have an immune-mediated form of psychosis that responds to antipsychotic treatments. And despite the remarkable nature of this case, the notion of whether or not this exists is still hotly debated. And I think that's a healthy part of the scientific process. But at the same time, it's not just April for me. I've now seen dozens of such cases over the years. And just through talking with colleagues, I have zero doubt in my mind that this entity exists.
So how does he convince others?
My thought is that another case report or two is unlikely to move the needle. And we really need hard biological data to be able to, for lack of a better word, convince people that this is real.
We'll talk about that. And
Dr. Pollan up at Harvard has cured schizophrenia using keto diets.
Wait, what? There's a cure for schizophrenia? We'll sort that out, too, when Petri Dish continues.
Support for Petri Dish is made possible by UT Health San Antonio's Mays Cancer Center, South Texas NCI-designated cancer center, providing cancer care for patients, advancing research, and educating the next generation of leaders. Mays Cancer Center is working to end cancer in South Texas and beyond. Learn more at mayscancercenter.org.
Welcome back to Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri. It is an interesting time to be a scientist.
Please welcome Secretary Kennedy.
In early February of this year, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. gave a speech at the Tennessee State Capitol.
Thank you all very much. And thanks for welcoming me here today on my first stop on the Take Back America tour.
To launch a national tour promoting the administration's new dietary guidelines linking diet with mental illness.
All kinds of emotional disease. We now know that that the things that you eat are driving mental illness in this country.
And he made a bold claim.
Dr. Pollan up at Harvard has cured schizophrenia using keto diets.
Now, if the keto diet could cure schizophrenia, it would be big news indeed. It is a diet that is heavy on fat and protein at the expense of the carbs that provide the glucose for our bodies that we use as fuel, which induces a state called ketosis. But Dr. Christopher Palmer at Harvard, to whom Kennedy was likely referring there, has never claimed to have cured schizophrenia. Palmer studies the relationship between metabolism and mental health with a focus on ketogenic therapies as potential treatments for psychiatric conditions. And he told the Harvard Crimson that while keto does appear to be promising for some patients with treatment-resistant schizophrenia, not all patients respond and others struggle to maintain the treatment. It is a difficult diet to stick to for regular folks, and the medical version is even more challenging. But I think this is another example of an evolution in the way we think about psychiatric conditions, where they come from, and how to treat them. We've been talking with Dr. Anthony Zogby, assistant professor in the departments of psychiatry and human molecular genetics at Baylor College of Medicine, who says there will be no one-size-fits-all approach to treating schizophrenia.
There may be cases that do respond favorably to ketosis. And the reason why is it seems like being in a state of ketosis does actually meaningfully affect neurotransmitter concentrations in the brain. And it's a validated treatment for certain types of epilepsy. That being said, it's not unlike how we're thinking about the immune component of schizophrenia. We would never go and give immune modulating treatments to every single patient, much like I wouldn't start with ketosis as the first line treatment for schizophrenia, because just the evidence supporting its use is not as strong, and we don't know which fraction of patients are going to respond favorably to ketosis. I think we need more research to better be able to understand who might actually benefit.
Which is where you are right now, doing the research, gathering the data.
So we are studying lots of individuals with schizophrenia and atypical forms of schizophrenia and using newer technologies to try to identify whether or not they have autoantibodies to different proteins that are relevant in the brain.
So you are trying to find evidence that the immune system may be attacking the brain in ways we haven't recognized before. Researchers have already uncovered more than 20 antibodies linked to psychiatric symptoms, including the one that caused Susanna Cahalan's anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis. And you're working with patients at Bentaub Hospital in Houston to find more.
Our study at Bentaub is looking at individuals with the full spectrum of psychosis, and we're using leftover blood samples. That's really all we need, is just looking at autoantibodies that are present in the serum, can then be tested to see if they react against human proteins. And that's really all that we're doing. And then we compare them to healthy individuals And we're trying to see, do patients with schizophrenia have more autoantibodies targeting proteins that we think are relevant for schizophrenia? For example, proteins that are in the brain, at synapses, and do the patients with schizophrenia have more of those or at higher concentrations than individuals who are healthy and without schizophrenia?
So what are you hoping to do here?
The first thing to do is to prove, one, that this entity exists, two, that we can have a biomarker test that we can administer to people that's a blood test that would actually tell them that this exists, and then we can do the research that comes down the road to better understand, okay, what types of treatments do those folks need, and how do they respond?
And ultimately, someday, if a patient presents with symptoms of schizophrenia, you could theoretically give them a test. And then what?
We actually have the treatments for these conditions, if you think about it. You know, we have plenty of good treatments. It's just that we don't know who within the schizophrenia spectrum actually has these conditions. That's why this is so important to get these tests.
There are several centers doing similar research. Columbia, where Zogby was when he met April, as well as universities in the UK, in Sweden, and Germany. And there is urgency here. Zogby is certain there are more Marys and more Aprils losing years, maybe losing their lives. But if they could be tested and treated, some have really good prognoses.
The really dramatic ones go back to being normal. They have minimal residual effects, and so they truly do get better, right? So if you think about the author of Brain on Fire, I mean, once she had NMDA receptor encephalitis, you know, some patients do have residual deficits, but like she, you know, obviously has fully recovered. So timing is quite important. Catching this early can be the difference between having residual brain damage or residual effects and not.
Right. A saying that I learned while researching this episode is time is brain, meaning every day untreated means a little more damage to the brain. So do you feel like you're in a race against time?
It does feel like that at times. I do feel quite a lot, like for my own, whatever my own reasons are, a sense of responsibility and internal pressure to get this done. We want to do it right, and we want to do it at the scale that it needs to be done at. But I know that there are more cases out there.
Because there is so much at stake, is there any way for doctors or family members or people experiencing symptoms to recognize that they might be experiencing an autoimmune condition?
Let's say somebody before the age of, you know, 15 or 16 develops psychosis. There should be a high index of suspicion that there may be an autoimmune process. So that's one group. Another group would be rapid onset of psychosis.
Right, like both Susanna Cahalan and April Borrell.
Yeah, so typically psychosis has a slow, steady kind of buildup of functional decline, odd beliefs that slowly emerge over the course of months. But if somebody goes from being very high functioning and overnight they develop severe psychotic symptoms, that is quite concerning. You know, of course, you have to be careful, though, because people use drugs. There's all sorts of reasons for why people might develop psychotic symptoms overnight, but it, in the right context, can be considered a red flag. Additionally, severe cognitive deficits, especially severe cognitive deficits that come on rapidly, would be concerning. So, for example, if someone simply, like, all of a sudden loses their memory and becomes psychotic, that could be concerning for autoimmune encephalitis. They become confused. They don't know what day it is. They don't know what year it is, et cetera. And then, of course, frank neurologic signs. So if you have psychosis plus new onset seizures, or psychosis plus one of your limbs becomes paralyzed, psychosis plus kind of clear neurologic signs or symptoms is another, you know, set of red flags that we tend to focus on.
So with April, she had markers of autoimmunity. What if you have lupus or Hashimoto's thyroiditis or subtypes of pernicious anemia? Or really any autoimmune condition, and you develop symptoms of psychosis, is that also a red flag?
Yes, I do think that that increases the index of suspicion, but there are going to be many people with autoimmune diseases who develop garden variety schizophrenia, but you're right, that would be another thing to keep in mind.
Zogby suspects between 1 and 5% of people diagnosed with schizophrenia are experiencing autoimmune encephalitis, and that would add up to more than a million people who could be helped. Some researchers think the number is far higher, and others think it's near zero. But immunopsychiatry is a growing field with its own office in the National Institutes of Health, and researchers suspect there may be links between autoimmunity and many psychiatric conditions, including post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, bipolar disorder, and depression. It is kind of a new era in psychiatry, Zogby says. It's just dawning at a glacial pace.
We have just been stuck in the old way of doing things in psychiatry for a very, very long time. And it will still continue to be slow. If you look at like cystic fibrosis, the amount of time that it took from identifying the gene to getting efficacious therapies that really are life-altering, you know, is multiple decades. And that's a much more straightforward biology than something like schizophrenia. So I'm, you know, eternally optimistic and genuinely believe that we will have better treatments, we will have better insight into the biology of these conditions. Just know that we're working really hard on it and that it takes time to get there.
Well, I will be watching. Thank you so much. Dr. Anthony Zogby is an assistant professor at Baylor College of Medicine in the departments of psychiatry and human molecular genetics and the chief of neuropsychiatric genetics within those departments. This episode of Petri Dish was produced by Jacob Rosati, TPR Vice President of News Dan Katz, and me. I researched, reported, and wrote the show. Jacob composed all the music, created the sound design, and edited the script. Petri Dish is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Bonnie Petri. Talk to you soon.